Exton Moss Experiment. Adventures in Wine and Space with Simon Exton and Ken Moss.
Hello everyone, Ken here, and welcome to the annual Exton Moss Experiment scrapbook of unused fragments from the cutting room floor. This is a selection of scenes that were deleted either for reasons of timing or just being a bit superfluous. First up is a selection of outtakes and trims from episode 92, in which we discuss the 1990s Tomorrow People story The Monsoon Man with the boys from the Peggy Mount Calamity Hour.
The Tomorrow People, circa 1990s. In particular, an episode from the third series. Is it the third series? Is it the second?
Well, it's weird because they did it in different series depending on where it was transmitted. But according to IMDb, it's the second series.
The second series. And rather than an episode, if you call it a story arc, because it is like five episodes.
Good point. I'll tell you what, Blackout, do you want to jump in and explain that bit?
Not particularly.
No, what I mean is what you've just said there, as it's... Where was I?
Do it from the top again. Go from the top again.
Nice, thanks. I can't remember what I said. Okay. Here we go.
Gentlemen, I've got to tell you, as you will find out, this is what every record of ours is like. this is why a record takes 6 hours and you get a half-hour episode out of it. Oh, sorry, can we edit out my laughing at that? That sounded more harsh than it should have, but yes, agreed.
Yeah. Have you boys seen Meet the Feebles?
No, I haven't seen that.
I've heard of it.
Oh, dear God. Do you know Peter Jackson's pre-Lord of the Rings work? So things like Braindead.
Yeah.
Yes.
In between that, and I'm a Derek and Derek's Don't Run, and he's got the flap in his head where he's putting all the seagull shit in, and Lord of the Rings, he did a Muppet piss take called Meet the Feebles, and they are just utterly, utterly filthy. And the main character, I can't remember her name, but she's a hippo.
Right.
Who's basically the Miss Piggy character, goes berserk at the end and mows down the entire cast with a machine gun, singing this very cutesy song called The Garden of Love.
Mint.
It is absolutely hilarious.
I shall dig that out. Absolutely brilliant. Love it.
I've got various other notes on various bits, but I've got to say, this did not hold my attention the way that The Living Skins did. Not that I want to watch The Living Skins ever again, as long as I fucking live. I just found it fascinating. This did not fascinate me. It was fine, but yeah, you know.
It's a bland theme tune for a bland show.
Yeah, no, it is.
I went into this with low expectations and I was not disappointed, but wasn't quite as terrible as I was expecting.
I suspect we're much on the same page there, Ken.
Yeah.
Where it's just like, I didn't hate it. There wasn't enough to like. And yet, oddly enough, there's not quite enough to hate either. It's just sort of fucking bland. It's, I don't know. And yet, it's entirely in keeping with what it's meant to be. I'm fine with it. I don't wish it didn't exist, but then I'll have no baggage with the original Tomorrow People either.
This next scene is a cut-down version of the 12th Doctor's regeneration from episode 94 in a general discussion about Doctor Who. The purpose was to demonstrate that less is more by editing out all the guff about pairs and words of advice for the next Doctor, but in the end it was felt it just slowed the episode down, so it wasn't included in the final edit. Episode 95 was another Tomorrow People discussion, this time with Cy Hart as our special guest. In this deleted clip, Dr. Exton and Cy briefly discuss their impressive level of book geekery.
And Cy, have you seen The Owl Service?
Yeah, I didn't like it.
Really?
I'm afraid I didn't get on with it at all. I can see why it's so well loved, but it just wasn't for me. It was just too obscure. And even for me, it was a bit too weird. And I'm not sure I quite got it. I think I need to read the book at some point and then come back to it.
Possibly, because I'd read the book before I saw it. And it might be one of those things like the adaptation of The City in the City. I loved that, but I already knew what the plot was beforehand. Alan watched it, and it's kind of science fiction that would kind of be his thing, and he hated it. He found it really disjointed, but he hadn't read the book beforehand. And do you know The City in the City?
Yes, yeah. I watched it. I haven't read the book, so again, I found it a bit impenetrable.
Yeah. China Meville writes absolutely superb conceptual sci-fi fantasy. City in the City isn't his best book. I mean, he's best known for Perdido Street Station, which was the one that he won all the awards for. I personally love Kraken. Perdido Street Station is very good. It kicks off that whole Baslag saga with Railsea, and they're all excellent. But I mean, my personal favourite is Kraken.
In episode 96, I open the door to the Imaginarium to see what a series of Doctor Who with John Hurt would have been like. And naturally, this paved the way for a lengthy discussion about Big Finish productions. Eager to skip all this and get to the main discussion about Callan, 7 minutes were chopped out. And here they are.
I know that there's, within fan lore, and this was actually postulated by people like Stephen Moffat and Russell T. Davies, I think, that the Time War started back, really, in Genesis of the Daleks. So that's where the Tom Baker connection comes in. I do think that they might have pushed the envelope a little bit too far with that.
No, I think they've ripped it apart by trying to cram way too much in the way that they do with pretty much everything. Mm. Because they're an excited little group of fanboys who go, we could do this, and we could do this, and we could do this. And it's like the old school Doctor Who fan groups used to go along to, and there would be sort of imaginative pissing contests of what if this and what if this and what if this. And Big Finish have the wherewithal to do what if this and what if the Murker ruled the galaxy. Make it happen. Do me 8 box sets.
I can't deny that
Nick
there
Briggs.
Is...
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Love to disagree, but I can't.
Make this happen, Briggs. You are our man for the minutiae. I'm being a bit unfair.
You don't touch unfair.
He's actually the only name I could think of from Big Finish. In reality, he's probably the one doing the, I have this marvellous idea for fan wank. Go and make it happen.
Oh, poor Nick Briggs. He's the nicest man in real life. But dragging us away from Big Finish just for a second. Big Finish, when they still had John Hurt to work with, they were peeling away the layers and getting to the heart of... They were forcing the War Doctor down a path he really didn't want to go down. Mm. And I really liked that. And now they've got Jonathan Carley to do the War Doctor when he was young. I've not heard any, but he does a wonderful impression of John Hurt. So I am going to buy those. I don't like recasting, but those I am going to buy.
But well, some recasting works, some recasting doesn't.
I think this Dodo. One is going to. Dodo and the new First Doctor they've got. Have you heard that trailer? Oh, my goodness me.
I was a little put off by your reaction.
Oh, dear. I can't remember the name of the actor they've got, but what are you doing? Absolutely not. He sounds nothing like William Hartnell. All the comments on Facebook were universally negative.
And going back to the Big Finish Time War, and they've massively spaffed themselves all over the place. The one exception to that, other than the War Doctor, is the Gallifrey series, which they've brought back.
I've never really...
Oh, I loved Gallifrey.
I think it's
one of the... A real Big Finish highlight. It kind of loses itself somewhere around the middle, and it probably dragged on a bit longer than it needed to before it stopped. But I'm really excited to see what they do now they're bringing it back. And I know they brought it back, and it's on Series 3 or something now. I just haven't got around to listening.
Series 3? It's about Series 8 and 9.
Now. No. The redone Gallifrey for the Time War.
Oh, the Time War series.
The original one, 6 or 7 series. And then there was some kind of special that I can't remember the details of and I never listened to. And they've brought it back for Gallifrey Time War. And it's got Louise Jameson. I think Lala Ward might be in it. Sean Carlson certainly is. Mark Gatiss, because of course. Sophie.
You're Arthur, a harsh bastard. Lucky to get somebody like Mark Gatiss. He is in demand.
Yeah. Doesn't mean he's any good.
I think he is. But
he is one of those who is a good comic and a good comic actor. And League of Gentlemen is absolutely brilliant. But he's like Catherine Tate. He's not a good actor.
Oh, I think you're being unnecessarily harsh.
Go on, name a Doctor Who that he's done well.
I quite like Twice Upon a Time. I did quite like it.
Yeah, but he is no more than competent in it. He looks bad because the three that he's playing up against are so good.
Well, he looks bad to you. I didn't have a problem with it. Lazarus Experiment he's in, what, less than half of?
Yeah, and he chews the scenery and not well.
But Lazarus Experiment isn't a good episode anyway.
It's not a terrible episode.
Nothing happens. They turn up, somebody goes young, then they turn into a monster, and then two-thirds of the episode are running around being chased by this monster. I mean, what else? He's done four Doctor Whos.
Idiot's Lantern, which I really like.
No, he's appeared in four Doctor
Whos. Oh, right, okay.
I can't remember what the others are.
So such spellbinding performances that you can't even remember the episodes. He's a perfectly competent jobbing actor. He is an extremely good comic actor. He should stick to his strengths. But he's a Doctor Who fan, so he wants to spaff over his little bit of fandom.
But yes, stepping away from Big Finish just for a second, a full series with John Hurt as the War Doctor, which in the chronology would have come between Paul McGann and Christopher Eccleston, so probably about 2001, 2002. And I think that, well, A, I just love John Hurt. He's got a voice. I wish I had John Hurt's voice. I would earn a lot of money with that. And he was really, really good in the 50th anniversary episodes that he was in.
He was. And again, I think it's the same argument with Weeping Angels. Utterly brilliant first appearance. Any further appearances would dilute it.
With John Hurt, really?
Yep.
Oh, he's one of those actors I can watch in anything. It doesn't matter what it is. The stuff that he's been in, some of it's not been particularly gripping. He was gripping in 10 Rillington Place and he's hardly in it.
Yeah, oh, he is a superb actor. I'm talking about the character. The character as a one-off appearance was absolutely brilliant and exactly what it needed. Further appearances would dilute
this. You see, the audio series that he did, I really loved. It's one of my favourite things that
they finished. That's fanfic. And
it doesn't take away from the fact. I enjoyed the stories.
The big problem with Doctor Who at the moment is that it's fanfic being made into telly. It's what Big Finish wanting to spaff things up the wall would do if they had control of the TV series. And this is why I've always disagreed with you that Big Finish should take over the TV series.
Oh, no, I've never said that.
Yes,
you have. No.
Yes, you have.
I've postulated that possibly Nick Briggs might be in the running, but that's not Big Finish. Because, yes, but...
It kind of is.
It kind of is, but that would be a different thing because you wouldn't just transfer...
It would be bloody awful because it would be as fan-wanky as Chibnall's stuff.
I've got to say, for all that the continuity-heavy stuff Big Finish have done, it's always slotted into the timeline. It's not been, we've got an idea. It completely rewrites the whole John Pertwee era, but it's clever. And Big Finish have never done that.
That is true, but... You also get things in the Chibnall era, like that god-awful bit in The Flux where, oh, well, we'll have the battle fleets of the Daleks and the Cybermen and I'll wipe them all out with one magic stroke. It is dreadful, unimaginative fan wank.
It's the kind of thing
that a local Doctor Who Appreciation Society group would come up with at 11 o'clock after they've been on the beer all night. And it's, wouldn't it be great if, and you sober up in the morning and it would actually be shite.
Shit, did we actually make that? Yeah, you did. Out, well, we better put it out now. Oh, flux off. But yes, more John Hurt Doctor Who, that would be my imaginarium conjuring for this time.
Right, well, I'm going to lock the door on that because it's a bad idea.
Can we go and watch Callan?
Yes.
It took us 102 episodes to get around to discussing Year of the Sex Olympics, after promising it to ourselves from the very start of our podcasting journey. The original version was broadcast in colour, but now only exists as a monochrome print, and this inevitably led to a chat about recolorised material, plus a discussion about the legalisation of cannabis as a result of the world portrayed in the film.
I think that a lot of black and white television that you see, I mean, particularly, you know, there's a lot of clips now of Doctor Who, the 60s Doctor Who that have been colourised, and they're getting it really. These are just fans that are doing this. It's not even industry professionals. Some of the Patrick Troughton stuff that's being put out, clips from the War Games and the Mind Robber, which is a very, Mind Robber's got a lot of black and white in it. Even that colourised just brings it all to life. And Year of the Sex Olympics, I'm vaguely familiar with prior to this, because it's one of those titles that's been bandied around over the years. I really should have seen it properly by now, because we've done Escape into Night for another episode, and that was originally in colour. Now, whether that would improve the story or not, I don't know. But
I don't think it would. Certainly the first four episodes are incredibly slow and dull. Would it be better as a four-parter? I think so. I think with that, it actually works quite atmospherically in black and white.
It does, actually.
It would actually work quite nicely if you did a sort of reverse Wizard of Oz and you had colour for the
real world stuff.
The real world sequences. And then when she's in the
in the dreamscape.
Then that is black and white, and that would make a nice crossover between the
two.
In the same way as Mind Dropper would work quite nicely if you kept episode one as black and white. Because there's almost no colour in it anyway. If you ignore the regulars' costumes, there would be basically no colour. And then when you go to the Land of Fiction, it's all in colour.
Yeah, because even the TARDIS is in black and white on the outside in that story.
Well, white.
Yeah, white. We cannot be trusted as a nation. This is why I argue for against things like the legalisation of cannabis. We cannot be trusted. You cannot use the Dutch model. You cannot use this fantasy that we would all be very sensible about it. People would be buying packets of 20 joints and smoking them like cigarettes, because that's what British people do.
Yeah, I disagree with you on the legalisation of cannabis. I think that as long as there is effective measures in place to stop and test and prosecute drivers under the influence, then I think it should be legalised. I completely agree with the argument that it's a gateway drug, but it's only a gateway drug because it's illegal.
The case in favour is quite a compelling one, but my overriding concern is still, it's Britain.
So
it's Britain.
Does that mean you're going to stop sale of alcohol or limit sale of alcohol? Because people will do exactly the same with that.
I agree.
And
yep.
Kids will overdo it. There is a very small percentage of the population who will continue to massively and unhealthily overdo it. Most of us enjoy a drink and at times will enjoy a little bit more than is recommended. But we remain functional. We don't do it all the time. There are people who do. There are people who would do that with cannabis. I think the resources that are put into place to stop the transport and the sale of cannabis would be much better used looking at crime with actual victims. I absolutely think it's a gateway drug, but it's a gateway drug because it's illegal. And I think if it were legalized in exactly the same way as if we had an alcohol prohibition, there would still be people buying alcohol under the counter, making their own or whatever. But because it was illegal, you would have to start breaking the law to get hold of it. If you're breaking the law for one thing, it's a very easy step to try experimenting with other stuff.
You don't need
to break the law.
I agree. It's this illicit thing. I will do it because I can't do it. I get where you're going with that. But
I think that's a minority of people. And I think that's a minority of people who wouldn't give a fuck what the law says anyway. I think the majority of people who enjoy cannabis would do it sensibly if it were legally available, and you would have quality control protections, so you wouldn't have it mixed with whatever
it's caught with,
diluting it. You'd know that you could rely on what you were getting, and you'd get a standardized amount. So you would know that you'd buy a packet of ciggies with a certain percentage of resin in it, or you'd be able to buy cooking cannabis that has a certain amount. So the effect would be predictable and safer.
I agree with everything that you've said, but it's my overriding concern is not people having it at home. It's not people smoking 20 joints a night. I don't particularly look down on people that use cannabis. It's there. It's not for me, but it's there.
Yeah.
My problem is with people that, and I hate stereotype, as you know, but it's the white van culture and the number of white vans that drift past. And you get that hit coming out of the driver's window.
And this
the
is
driving
why,
around, that is the concern.
This is why
I've got.
I said that for legalisation, you need to have effective safety controls on people who are driving under the influence. So you'd need to be able to get a roadside test done quickly and easily in the same way as you can with being breathalyzed for alcohol.
Yeah, it's certainly not a pious attitude. It's more the tiny, tiny percentage of dicks that would smoke joints at the wheel. I know you're not even supposed to smoke at the wheel, but...
But that tiny percentage of dicks do that now anyway.
They do. You're quite right. It's just another thing that they would then legally be. But everything you're saying
is doing it behind the wheel wouldn't be legal.
Oh, no. But say that they'd smoked half a pack of joints in the morning, you know. They'd had a joint with breakfast and then got in the car and goes to work and then mowed down a little girl.
In which case they would be prosecuted in the same way as they'd done that if they downed a half a bottle of vodka before going to
work. It's just one more thing that people can't be trusted with. I wish I had a more liberal
that argument, then that's an argument for absolute alcohol, prohibition. Yes.
I know.
I don't particularly like cannabis. I've tried it and I did inhale. and I've eaten space cake. It's not for me.
I also produce an LGBT podcast with Paul Alsrush called 9 Bob Note. And in an episode discussing vaccine mandates with the good doctor and his husband Alan Fogg, there were some inevitable innuendo-laden outtakes.
Let's roll it back to England.
Boo.
Get out.
No, I'm patriotic.
Mute the mic, I'm going for a munch.
Sorry, Nigel.
Don't be silly, Paul. Windsor Uber Hours.
alas, I've muted the mic because it was going for a munch.
Oh. Can't have the whole of the 2022 outtakes from one day.
Basically, yes.
Jesus, are you doing 9 Bob Note outtakes as well?
There was a 9 Bob Note outtake that I didn't include on the deleted scenes because it was 9 Bob Note, but I wrestle with myself. Where the fuck was I going with this? England.
England,
I think you were
going
to start
Uber
singing.
Yes.
And did those feet.
It wasn't Jerusalem, I promise. What the fuck was I talking about? No, it's like I was talking about in a previous episode that in England, forcing somebody to have something put in you that you don't...
Oh, dear God.
He's licking the microphone again. It's a disgusting habit. But
one of those tasty licks has got a fair muff over it.
I've actually brought him a muff cover just so that he can't do that, actually.
Well, you've done more of that than us.
The final segment is an aborted episode looking at the first episodes of various unrelated series. This kept getting pushed down the release schedules and eventually shelved after we enjoyed Children of the Stone so much that we did a full episode on it in 2021. Never once to waste half-decent material, here are two half-cut mates chatting on a sofa in 2019.
Hello everyone, welcome to the latest edition of the Exton Moss Experiment. I'm Ken Moss.
I'm Simon Exton.
And today we look at first episodes. Simon, what are we first episoding?
What we're going to look at is some first episodes from classic children's young adult TV series. We've got a couple from the 1960s, we've got a couple from the 1970s. So all before your time, really.
They are.
I remember both the 1970s ones and being absolutely hooked on them.
The names are familiar, but I've never seen any of them.
So in the 1960s, we're going to be looking at the first episodes of Pathfinders in Space and then Object Z. And from the 1970s, we're going to look at the first episode of The Changes and the first episode of Children of the Stones. But before we get to that, we have a couple of regular things that we need to do, don't we?
As if on cue, my ice has just popped. Time for the tonic screwdriver.
Today we're looking at Sly Gin, and the little bit of information that comes with it says that it's a classic London dry gin with bags of spruce like juniper. Complex herbal mid-tones of lavender and bay seasoned with rosemary and sweet spice, leaving a lingering herbal/citrus aftertaste with an almost creamy lemon, thyme and grapefruit finish. They really do write a load of rubbish on this. These kind of descriptions, you know the bit in Black Books where Fran looks around her shop and says, I really do sell a pile of wank. Well, that's kind of what these descriptions remind me of. But look, they've got their own rating scale.
And nothing Bernard's.
it misses out by not being Bernard's. Anyway, triviality aside, what do you think of the gin? Oh, blimey, 43%. Apparently this has got apple mint in. I've no idea what apple mint is. It's not apple and mint, it's just apple mint. I'm going to stop reading these little card things because...
They've been no relation whatsoever. It's very nice, but I can't say that I'm...
Again, much like the last one, there's nothing to blow me away with it.
I think this is nice. It's subtle. There is definitely a citrusy flavour.
There is.
A sort of herbally, florally flavour as well, which doesn't last terribly long. Citrus flavour lasts longer. Mm. It's a perfectly nice gin. Don't think it's particularly special.
No,
I'd give it a safe three.
A three from me as well.
Yeah. Right, so moving on from that, regular segment is the Black Archive.
I'll open the door. What would you like to bring out this week?
In view of the fact that we're looking at these sort of aimed at young teenager sci-fi serials, I would like to bring out of the Black Archive the first one of those that the BBC did from way back in 1954 called The Lost Planet, an adaptation of a novel by Angus McVicar. It was the story of a group of people going to an alien planet and was reasonably well received at the time. And it was transmitted after Quatermass Experiment, but before Quatermass 2, so making it the BBC's second science fiction serial and first completely missing science fiction serial. And it spawned a sequel, I think, 2 years later, which was Return to the Lost Planet. So that's what I'm going to bring out of the Black Archive this time. What would you like to?
Well, this is on the back of something I was watching the other day about comedy. It just happened to be one of those comedy nostalgia documentaries about. And it was a series of four programmes from the 60s to the 90s. It got me thinking to the comedy programmes that used to be on when I was younger and the types of TV. It's on London Palladium, that sort of thing, and the variety programmes. And everybody that you used to see on Blackpool Pier performing each year as you drove through the eliminations. There are a lot of first appearances on New Faces. The vast majority of them are missing. Mm. Out of 160-odd, 130-odd are missing. And I just think that would be something worth having back, if only to fill in those gaps, because a lot of first appearances.
Yeah, see, do I remember New Faces, or is it Opportunity Knocks I remember?
I've got in my head that it was Marty Kane. Oh, she took over hosting New Faces, I think.
Yeah, because New Faces dates back to the 60s, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's what I mean. She
was more late 70s.
Yeah, but New Faces went on for ages.
Was it not Huey Green?
No, Opportunity Knocks was Huey Green. Mm. According to Wikipedia, it was originally presented by Leslie Crowther, then by Derek Hobson, who I can't say as I remember, and then Marty Kane.
You see, I remember watching things like that, and yeah, there might be the occasional person worth watching, but the rest of them.
Oh, it's like anything else. It was.
Didn't they have the clapometer?
I've got that in my head as being Bob Monkhouse's Opportunity Knocks. They may have done, but I certainly remember on when Bob Monkhouse was doing Opportunity Knocks in the 80s. As I said to somebody only this past week, you could have any Fraggle-faced kid on it with a limp and a small dog, and they would win. Because the clapometer was basically the sympathetometer. But it was shit. It was a shit idea then, and it is now. It's like anything else. You look back on these programmes with nostalgia, and they show a lot of the best clips, and you think, yeah, I used to really love that. And then you watch it back, and you realise you love bits of it, but the vast majority was rubbish, really.
You see, there are things that I can think of that I look back on and I used to watch with my grandparents. And some of them were rubbish and would be rubbish now. Sailor of the Century. My grandmother loved and was dreadful, and it was dreadful at the time.
Don't think I ever saw it, because that was
live from Norwich. It's the quiz of the week with I won't say Leslie Crowther.
I won't say Leslie Crowther, but that was Price is Right.
I don't think it was Eamon Andrews, maybe.
Oh, that might be.
There's probably tons of them missing, and no desperate desire to see any of them again. So we could blether on about old TV stuff, well, we do.
It's almost like that's what the point of this podcast is.
But shall we crack on with the first episode of Pathfinders in Space? The Pathfinder series was four consecutive serials on ITV. First was Target Luna, which was transmitted as live and not tele-recorded. And then there was Pathfinders in Space, Pathfinders to Mars, Pathfinders to Venus, all three of which exist in their entirety, which for a programme of this vintage is doing pretty well. Mm. And it's the story of a British Rocket Research Department who actually managed to send their rocket up into space.
Without killing anybody.
And not kill anybody in the attempt, because it's a, a kids program, then it's the kids of lead scientist who end up on board the rocket for whatever reason, along with their pet hamster. Hamlet the hamster becomes an important part of the crew. Because it's essential with these things to have
a link kiddie to the kiddies.
Kiddie yes. characters that the audience will engage with. And that's true for three of the four that we're going to watch today. It was one of the programmes that was a precursor to Doctor Who. And Sid Newman had seen the success of this and wanted something that would replicate this success. So the first episode is called Convoy to the Moon, and it was transmitted on the 11th of September 1960. So predating Doctor Who by quite a while. Mm.
Main control room to MR2. Are you in the nose cone now?
Yes, we are now in the nose cone.
Right. Ignite primary motors on MR2.
Ignite primaries, MR2.
All right, come on, boys. Get down on your anti-gravity bunks.
This is the way to do it, Mr. Henderson. Just lie on your back as though you're in place.
All right, are we all ready?
I'm ready.
So is Hamlet.
Oh, Jimmy, what did you bring that for?
He likes it.
Yeah.
Five. Do you
think we'll make it? Three.
Two.
One. Zero. Right, that was the first episode of Pathfinders in Space, Convoy to the Moon.
And I realised, looking at the credits, that one of the reasons Sidney Newman would have been keen for this to be used as a guide for what Doctor Who could be like was because he'd produced this.
Mm, funny about that. I think it was actually mentioned in An Adventure in Space and Time as one of the things that he'd done.
Quick shout out to a couple of Who alumni. Gerald Flood, who plays the lead reporter, Conway Henderson, was King John in The King's Demons and the voice of Chameleon.
Mm-hmm.
Harold Goldblatt, who plays Dr. O'Connell, who's one of the scientists that we'll talk about, was Professor Dale in Frontier in Space. So the whole premise is that a British rocket experimentation is preparing their second rocket launch. Now, in the previous serial, Target Luna, that was a launch of a spaceship that just swung around the moon and then came back to Earth. And during that, the young son of one of the scientists in the programme, Professor Wedgwood, had gone up in the rocket by mistake, and it was all about talking him back down again. So, rather than doing the sensible thing and banning all children from the area, start off with a massive security alert because Jimmy has been let wander into some very secure area, along with his pet hamster, Hamlet, which he seems to be glued to, and who ultimately becomes Hamlet the space hamster, along with Jimmy's two siblings, Jeffrey and Valerie. Now, the other person who turns up is a reporter, Conway Henderson, who gives Jeffrey a present of a screwdriver, which is kind of a loading a gun in Act 1 to have it go off in Act 3. Except that very soon after that, one of the two rockets that they have ready to go, the supply rocket. The plan, as explained to them, is that this is going to be a manned expedition to the moon. Four scientists are going to go in a first rocket, the MR-1. And then there's going to be an unmanned, autopilot-controlled supply rocket, MR2. And there's a fault in it. So despite the fact they've got loads of white-coated technicians wandering around the place, they send Jeff with his marvellous new screwdriver over to repair it. And he seems to repair it. And then forgets and leaves his screwdriver there. So when MR2 comes to take off, the screwdriver falls into the autopilot, short-circuits it, and it will take a week to replace, by which time the people on the moon will have run out of supplies. So they decide to strip it all out and send it up with a manual pilot. And Conway Henderson, the reporter, volunteers to do this, despite having no experience at all. And amazingly, the scientists agree to this interesting plan. Even more interesting is the fact that as his crew, he chooses two of the three Henderson children. The first being the eldest, Jeffrey, who's the one who destroyed the autopilot in the first place. And the second, because of his extensive in-space experience, is the youngest of the three children, Jimmy, who then sneaks aboard Hamlet, the space hamster, as well. The rocket takes off effectively, and as they're taking off, a space-suited figure falls out of a cupboard in the spaceship cabin. Unsurprisingly, this will turn out to be Valerie.
Never.
Who was not happy about the fact that she was being
left behind. She was a girl, and they get scared, you know.
Yeah, that was a 10-year-old kid saying that. So,
I've never seen any of that before. Because that was that 1960?
1960, yeah.
Yeah. As it opened up and unfolded, I was actually quite impressed. A, by the... some of the model work's actually quite good. Certainly the scene setting on the island.
And when you consider this is less than 10 years after Quatermass experiment. Mm.
And I actually thought when I first saw it that it was a helicopter shot, and then it panned down a little clumsily and it was revealed to be a model shot, but very good. And just the setup and what it was all very obvious and full of 1950s tropes. It quickly descended into very obviously a children's programme.
Yeah, let's crowbar the children in so we've got something that the audience will relate to.
But having small children wandering around with electric screwdrivers, repairing things, just letting them roam around at free will, and every time there was anything that was vaguely amiss, young Jimmy, or the older one in the suit, got his hair ruffled, you little scamp. Now, come on, we'll put it right. Not to worry, you've just destroyed £500,000 worth of space equipment. Oh, goodness me, the scrapes you young boys get into. You young scallywag. You've got the girls get scared, you know. And a receptionist or assistant that's straight out of Paula's answering service.
Oh, she's a little bit more dynamic than Paula.
Well, she'll be replaced instantly. She's too far too laid back. She's clearly not taking the job seriously enough.
And she does actually move occasionally.
She does, yes. And not just her lips, her entire facial muscles.
Yeah, and during the briefing, Professor Wedgwood appears to be smoking a bonfire.
The number of scales that we've got now for episodes that we watch.
Let's not be adding another one.
Let's not add another one, but just as a hypothetical one. I'm a pipe smoker, so I pick up on these things when they appear. And it's one of those indicators that somebody is an academic, if they're holding a pipe. 2 points if they've got thick glasses on, and full 10 out of 10 if they've got the lab coat as well, or a tweed jacket.
But it has to have elbow patches.
It does have to have elbow patches, that is essential. They do vary, though, wildly between the barely packed or not lit at all to this one, which was positively brimming and in danger of incinerating the entire thing. That was the most lit pipe I've ever seen in my life. On the whole, I did enjoy it, although I can't say that I'd be rushing to watch more. Again, very much of its time. Not a bad thing.
And it's very much a set-up episode.
Yeah.
It gets more interesting as we go through the series.
But production-wise, I was quite impressed for the time that it looked that good. Because it would have been made on a shoestring, and it was all right.
Yeah, and it looked as good as anything sci-fi, apart from the Daleks, in the first series of Doctor Who.
Mm.
Very limited in terms of the number of sets. But then that was a lot of 60s drama. Mm.
So yeah, I imagine that it was quite well received by the kiddies.
Well enough received for this to already be a sequel and for there to be two more.
Mm.
And then for the same production team to take two of the lead actors, so Joel Flood and Stuart Gudotti, who plays Geoffrey Wedgwood in this. He's not actually the original Geoffrey Wedgwood. In the previous one, the character was played by Michael Kreis.
The young boy?
No, the older one. Geoffrey.
Oh, yeah, the one in the suit.
Yeah, and that would have been, what, 6 years before he was Ben?
66, so yeah.
Because Target Luna was also 1960, so the sequel was produced very quickly.
Right.
And those two actors were then taken out and given a further three science fiction serials, all set underwater. Those Plateau of Fear, which were again put out live and not tele-recorded, but City Beneath the Sea and Secret Beneath the Sea, both of which fully exist.
Very good survivability then for the period. Mm.
Yeah, five full serials out of seven.
So, moving on.
Moving on, we're carrying on with the 1960s theme, and we've got the first episode of Object Z. The bonus of this series is that an observatory, again in Scotland, so Scotland's doing pretty well on the science.
As it was with The Nightmare Man, that was set in Scotland as well.
Set in Scotland, filmed in Cornwall.
Mm.
This astronomical research group discovers some sort of meteor object that is heading towards the Earth and likely to hit,
right.
And how the world reacts to that.
Well, without further ado, Ron VT, when is this from?
This is the first episode of Object Z. It's an episode called The Meteor. It was from the 19th of October 1965. It was the first of six episodes, all of which survive. There was a six-episode sequel called Object Z Returns from 1966, I think. I think the first episode of that survives, but nothing else.
Right. Well, let's give it a whirl then.
I come to call you tonight with news of the gravest importance to this country and to the world. An object from outer space may well pass close to the Earth before going on into the vastness of space. It is possible, and I tell you this in the light of the best scientific advice available, that it may strike the Earth a glancing blow. It is even possible that it may score what I can only describe as a direct hit. It is for this reason that work has begun on the building of shelters against the impact. Should this object collide with the Earth, the shock will be very great. And the provision of adequate shelters is the best chance we have of preventing severe loss of life.
Right, that was episode one of Object Z, the meteor from 1965.
The premise is that it starts off in a Scottish observatory, and two, I assume they're postgraduate students, have noticed a new object in a bit of the night sky that they're looking at. And they discuss this with their supervisor, who agrees that it's not a supernova, and their best first guess is that it's a meteor. In this first scene, we also meet a journalist, played by Trevor Bannister, who is aiming to persuade this astronomer to do a TV programme discussing the ins and outs of astronomy and the night sky. The journalist goes back to London, and in the meantime, the scientists realise that this is an object that's heading pretty much directly towards the Earth and may well hit a glancing blow. And depending on what the meteor is made of, this may or may not be just about survivable. In the meantime, the security services have got involved. There is a security advisor who turns up at the first episode of the TV show that they're doing. And at the end of the TV show, there is an announcement to the public by the Prime Minister of this approaching object, and that they're going to start building shelters and making plans for dealing with it. The two postgraduate students have also come to London to wish their professor luck, and all three astronomers are collected by the security services at the end and told that they're imminently needed in Woomera in Australia, and that they will be on a plane that's departing in a couple of hours. So there's an awful lot of setting up. In just 5 years since Pathfinders, there's been a big upswing in production values. The whole staging is less static than Pathfinders was. The dialogue is more natural. There are no convenient children that will introduce you into the dialogue. It's a much more slick television-looking production.
Although we've regressed 10 years in terms of RP, terribly, terribly RP, all the way through.
Apart from the Prime Minister's aide, who has some weird Scottish accent via Bulgaria.
That's doing a tour of Europe, Eastern Europe.
And halfway through the scene, he just seems to forget the fact that he's supposed to have an accent and lapses back into English.
The whole thing to me was like a science lecture by the back door. It was all... There was a lot of expository dialogue.
Well, there was in Pathfinders, and at the time, this kind of science fiction kids programme would have been...
Oh, so this was a kids programme? Wasn't... Ah, right.
Would have been at least in part educational.
Mm. Oh, on that level, it definitely succeeds in all sorts of ways, from the physical, astronomical, even some ballistics in there.
I remember my PhD supervisor... One of the TV shows that he used to talk about being absolutely glued to when he was a kid was Object Z.
The story behind it is primed for being remade. I mean, it's a very familiar story. Something's going to crash into Earth and it'll be a disaster.
It goes off in a completely different direction, though.
Might be worth revisiting then.
No, it turns out that it's all a hoax. The scientists of the world have got together and produced this hoax to unite the governments of the world. And so they've given them something to concentrate on rather than bickering amongst themselves.
You sneaky bastards.
Yeah. Now, the sequel, they actually have a real object heading towards the Earth. And the first big problem is,
we've been here before.
We believed you last time, and why should we believe you this time? So, yeah, you think Armageddon and all those films about an object heading towards the Earth. No, this is a very different story.
Oh, excellent. No, pity that we don't have it.
It exists in the archives, so hopefully the lovely people at Network will at some point make this available for us to see.
Well, the copy that we've got here is quite low grade, so presumably that's not how it looks in the archive, and with a bit of cleaning up it could look quite nice.
Yes, because all that flashing across is video effect, isn't it?
It's just shash, and dropouts and things.
Yeah, it's demonstrating the fact that this is an X-generation copy, and actually this is much better quality than a lot of the Doctor Who I used to watch back in the day.
I remember people saying that they had audio copies of Doctor Who's from the 60s, where it was basically... And everyone used to get excited that they were listening to Edge of Destruction from 90. Couldn't make out a word, but it was the fact that it was there. Yeah, the idea behind it I do like, particularly now that you've just explained what really happens. Yeah, but a better hook for me than Pathfinders in Space. If that was for... I'm a firm believer in this, that children's programmes should treat kids with the same level of intellect as adults. When you're going to make something along this line, they switch onto it and they understand a lot more than they're given credit for. Yeah. Particularly when they're allowed to be... When they're allowed to, yeah. What is next in the can? We're moving into the 70s for this, aren't we?
So we're jumping ahead by 10 years to 1975, and we're going to look at the first episode of The Changes. I remember seeing this at the time and thinking it was absolutely brilliant. This was the first episode called The Noise from the 6th of January 1975. Maybe I saw a repeat or something, because I'd have been a bit young to be really taking notice of stuff then. Although actually thinking back, the thing that I remember is the title sequence, which is absolutely brilliant. Now watching it since and having read the books that it was based on, because it's based on a trilogy of books by I think Peter Dickinson, and it's all about what happens to the world, but as seen through the eyes of England, when technology stops working. It's a 10-part serial with two brilliant opening episodes and two brilliant closing episodes, and a lot of fun, vaguely interesting, but obviously padding six episodes in between.
Right.
So we're going to watch the first episode of this.
What's he saying?
More reports are coming in from all over the country about abnormal weather conditions. The Meteorological Office has reported an unusual number of severe thunderstorms. There have been cloudbursts and torrential rain on the Welsh borders, and there are reports of severe flooding. Houses have been struck by lightning.
Well, what's wrong with this telly?
Scotland and Hampshire. Heavy snows with drifting have been reported in Yorkshire, and there are unconfirmed reports of earth tremors.
Well, that was the first episode of The Changes from 1975, and it starts off with a schoolgirl, Nikki Gore, living with her parents in Bristol. And while they're watching TV one night, there is a report of bad weather throughout the country, and suddenly they start hearing a noise, and her father goes berserk and smashes and destroys the television. The noise stops, he goes back to normal and is pretty shocked by what he's done. And then a little while later, the noise starts up again and all three of them start smashing up every bit of machinery that they can find. There's a lot of OB work showing people running around the streets of Bristol, dragging machinery out of houses, smashing houses, even things like bicycles. And also there is establishing footage of terrible weather in other parts of the country, snows, floods, that kind of thing, and buildings blowing up, explosions, train carriages catching alight, car engines catching fire. The family decide that they're going to leave. Everybody that they go past is making plans to leave the city. And while they're doing that, the noise starts again. Nikki gets taken over and starts smashing a car. And when she noise stops and she comes back to normal, she's lost her parents. So Mrs. Gore is pregnant and they're worried about the baby. Her parents decide that after not being able to find her, that they're going to carry on to France, and that the father, once his wife is safe and established in France, will come back and try and find Nikki. So that's what they do. Nikki is left alone in the city and she wanders around finding food, eventually running into an old man who says that the few people that are left, there have been quite a number of deaths because of some sort of waterborne infection, and that she should get out of the city and head towards France. So it's very much a get away from here, get away from the country. And that's the point at which it stops. This is 10 years later than Object Z. Mm. There's, again, a massive ramp up in production values. Huge amount of outside broadcast work to establish the fact that this is taking over the whole city. I'd say most of the episode was OB, wasn't it?
It was all filmed on. There were no studio work in that at all. Even the scenes in the house were a real house. That wasn't a set.
I mean, there was an awful lot of stock footage as well.
There was some, yeah, there was. But
one of which
fair,
is the same stock footage they used at the end of Image of Fendel.
If it's not, it's extremely close to it.
Yeah.
I can't quite believe that that was a kiddies programme, largely because of A, how well it was made, and B, it's quite grim as a hook for the rest of the series.
And she never meets up with her parents again. The whole of the rest of the series is her story.
Well, so then they don't turn up again at all.
No, they disappear off to France, and she does leave the city. She gets involved with a Sikh family who are travelling through southern England, and she gets involved with a group of people who are on a barge.
Right, it's all revealed in the end as to the.
It is, and it's all down to Merlin waking up and wanting his country back.
So Merlin was the first Brexiteer. I'm assuming, purely because it was so conspicuous.
I mean, there's an explanation at the end. There's no actual resolution.
I was just going to say that the only thing that was conspicuous about the whole thing was that final blatant shot of a crystal in a cave somewhere. I'm assuming that that is...
Yes, that becomes important in the final episode.
Right.
I think that's an incredibly atmospheric start to a show. If I hadn't seen it all before, that would definitely compel me to watch more.
Yes.
Now, as I say, the first two episodes are similarly good and fast-moving and effective, and then it really slows down for six episodes or so, and there's a lot of running about and capture, escape, recapture bits of it. And then the final couple of episodes is the explanation of what's gone on.
I'm looking at it thinking how, because the first thing I'm reminded of, as with a lot of these British apocalyptic things now, is the obvious, trying not to refer to it too often, the threads. I can't imagine in my wildest dreams that they would make anything that grim for children's television today. Social media would be a light calling for the heads of everybody involved in the production for traumatizing the little snowflakes. But War Games syndrome, episodically and hideously flabby in the middle.
Or do episodes 1, 2, 9 and 10.
And it wouldn't really make any difference.
I mean, there'd be a significant jump, but you wouldn't miss out on anything plot-wise. If I was going to watch it again, that's the way I'd do it.
Mm. Yeah, great stuff. What have you got for our final vignette?
We're jumping ahead by a couple of years to 1977, and we're going to watch the first episode of The Children of the Stones. It's an episode called Into the Circle from 10th of January 1977. It stars Gareth Thomas as a university lecturer, I think, and he and his son move to a small village, and weird things happen. And it's filmed around Avebury, so it's a small village inside a stone circle, hence the Children of the Stones.
What could possibly go wrong?
Oh.
Ron VT.
Margaret, this is Adam Brake. Poor fellow doesn't know anyone in the village and wants to be taken under your wing.
Why mine?
I think he likes the look of the feathers.
Maybe. I think I'm going to need your help. I'm doing some research on the circle, the stones.
I know. A village is a small place, Mr. Adam.
I'm as up to date as academically possible on the circle, but, well, I'm sure you must have some theories.
Oh, yes. I've plenty of theories.
I'd very much like to hear them.
Come to the museum tomorrow. We can talk then.
Sherry and et cetera.
Thank you.
Welcome to Milbury, Mr. Brake.
Indeed. And may I include you both in my usual toast? Old times and new.
Quite a creepy little episode for a kids' TV programme. It starts off with a physics professor, Adam Brake, who is moving to a village called Maybury inside a stone circle with his son, Matthew. And he's going to do 3 months' research into the stones and their magnetic properties. While they're driving inside the circle, one of the stones suddenly appears in front of them. And so he breaks his car and the stone is only there for a flash of a second. And is replaced by their new housekeeper. He apologises for almost hitting her. They go back to the cottage he's renting. And there's a lot of very calm chit-chat from her. Until Matthew shows her a picture that he's found of a stone circle with a beam of light coming out of it. and a giant fanged snake leading away from it. And she's very affected by this and faints. Then Ian Cuthbertson turns up, doesn't really explain who he is, although everybody in the village defers to him as though he's a squire. And when he touches the housekeeper, she instantly comes back awake, says that she's fine, goes to get them a cup of tea and things. And they start to talk about why Adam has come to the village to do his research. Takes him to the local pub and introduces him to the local museum curator who moved there with her daughter about 6 weeks previously. Matthew, meanwhile, has met up with some of the local school children who really divide into two groups. One small number of kids, including the daughter of the museum curator, who are normal, larking about, mischievous kids, and a larger group who are very controlled, calm, well-behaved, and when it comes to doing their lessons, very advanced in terms of mathematics. And there are quite a few sort of Children of the Damned moments.
Yes.
Visiting the museum, Adam is shown a map of local ley lines, which all terminate at the circle, and there are 53 ley lines on the map, 53 stones left in the circle. While this is going on, Matthew has been spied on by a bloke with a periscope.
Periscope
would be a little bit weird.
It would be a little...
It would be a little Ludwig. and towards the end of the episode, this fella jumps out in front of Matthew while he's cycling along. And Matthew swerves off, hits his head on a stone and is knocked out. At the same time, Adam has been persuaded to touch one of the stones. He touches the stone and gets a vision of lots of the villagers, including his son, cowering away from something. And they're brightly lit. And at the very end of the vision, there's a couple of people, what looks like a man and a woman, running away from it. That's the end of the first episode. Now, I think this is brilliantly creepy. I think it's by far the most atmospheric of all four that we've seen today.
It is, and I'm going to ask you to leave it behind so that I can finish watching it, because I think that that is great.
It is, and it just gets better and better and better. In that case, I won't tell you what the remainder of the plot is.
All these, I've said it many times before, occult country English villages isolated with something sinister going on that involves any sort of magic or rituals, I think makes brilliant television. Yeah. I think it always has. I think a lot of the stuff that was made in the 70s, more of the 70s than the 80s, really screws it down, and it's all intriguing stuff.
Yeah, and there were a number of these TV shows from around the mid to late 70s written by Burnham and Ray, like this was. So Raven, King of the Castle, that kind of thing. And they all have this sort of creepy, sinister, harking back to ancient times, fairly heavily rooted in traditional British mythology.
Mm.
And they're all well worth a watch.
That one, certainly. Yeah. It helps that the cast, Gareth Thomas and Ian Cuthbertson, starters.
And Veronica Strong, who isn't a Who alumnus, but did play Virginia Cortez, who was one of the leads in Virgin of the Secret Service,
which
is a really fun little series we'll do when we're coming on to do Victoriana.
No, just for the whole atmosphere that it's set up in.
I mean, there is no doubt that would get you tuning back in next week, wouldn't it?
Yeah, that would. I'd be happy to watch that if that was on now, let alone 40 years ago.
Yeah. And as you say, it's a level of creepy that you just wouldn't get in kids' TV shows these days.
But I don't think it would do them any harm. I look at the sanitised American crap that's on television now, and I don't know, every generation seems to look at the one that's coming up as, oh, God, kids today and this and the other. I just don't think that they're given the sort of output that we were.
Yeah. And actually, in a lot of ways, this reminds me of the kind of atmosphere that you get with the Sapphire and Steel stories.
Yes.
And again, minimal special effects.
Apart from that blend at the very end when he touched the stone.
I mean, there's the cut between the stone and the...
Mrs.
Crabtree.
Crabtree, yes.
And also there's a similar cut between the Freddie Jones character who's been spying on Matthew.
Mm.
He cuts backwards and forwards between the stone.
But yeah, anything with little creepy country English villages. And the music as well.
The sound design was fantastic, and that very Celtic,
Clannad-esque. I think it's all a cappella. I don't think there's actually any instruments involved at all.
If there is, they're very subtle in background,
but very evocative. Of the things we've watched today, top marks for that one. That's the favourite.
And some nice set his cottage was really nice.
Yeah, it was
nice.
Yeah.
The museum's a little bit sparse for a museum, but then...
It probably would be.
Museums probably wouldn't have their own curator. Mm. As the story goes on, you'll realise why she's there.
And the pub, of course, which is a traditional, essentially West Country English pub in the middle of nowhere.
Empty during the day, though.
Yeah. Which probably would be, though, to be honest. It's clearly set in farmland.
But with a village in the middle of it, so they've got at least one wandering weirdo that you'd expect.
Yeah, old man with a telescope. But yeah, I very much enjoyed it, and I can understand why you hold that so fondly, even after just one episode. Hmm. Well, all in all, a nice afternoon's dip into children's television from the past 50 years. Thank you very much.
Yep, they were fun to rewatch.
But thank you very much for listening, everyone. I hope you've enjoyed what we've had to say. We'll be back, as ever, in a couple of weeks with the next episode. Take care.
Goodbye now.
The Exton Moss Experiment featured Simon Exton and Ken Moss. All featured soundtracks are the property of their respective producers, and no infringement of copyright is intended. Title music was performed by the BBC Symphony Orchestra, and the programme was produced by Maverick Productions. For more information, please visit maverickproductionsuk.blogspot.com or find us on social media.